is a podcast from the Refugee Studies Centre. To learn more about our work, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Hit the nail on the head. That's the kind of message I want to get across. So if any of you are not too keen on the idea of new Ottomanism, you won't be happy with my talk, because I'm hoping that I'm going to bring you around to understanding why current refugee policy in Turkey has some pretty strong origins in the 19th century and are really unusually successful. But I'd like to start with an anecdote. I mean, those of you who know me know that I've been working in the Middle East for a very long time, and that I began my work with nomads and with an attempt to deconstruct the policies in development about settling nomads. And in the mid-1970s, I was in the region exploring possible areas where I could conduct my research. And I had arrived in Beirut, and I looked around Lebanon, and they told me there were no nomads there. I'd gone to Syria. I knew there were a lot of nomads there, but I had a kind of lukewarm reception. Eventually, I went to Jordan and asked around there. They were quite keen on a study, but they wanted me to have a military escort. I mean, it's the kind of thing you hear about, but I don't think anthropologists are very keen on military escorts when they're running around trying to interview people. Anyway, at the end of about 3 weeks, I knew how to get around, and I was in Amman. And the way you move around the Middle East, or used to in those days, is unless you had a lot of money, and I didn't, you would go down to the central entrepot and hire a seat on a shared taxi that traveled between the different cities. So I went down to this part of Amman, and I waited. And the drivers of these shared taxis sort of stand up and they sing song and they call out Beirut, Damascus, Aleppo, Yani Homs, Sudmore, whatever. And I was sort of waiting around until the taxi driver called out Damascus. And eventually one of them did, and I saw that there was one person there, and I thought, well, I'll head over in that direction, because maybe by the time I get there, there might be three more people, and then we can just head off, because you could end up sitting in the taxi for an hour, 2 hours, waiting. And as I was heading that direction, I heard another taxi driver call out Grozny. Grozny. And I kind of went, where? Grozny? From Amman? And I sort of thought, why would a taxi want to go to Grozny from Amman? Just shows you how little I knew about the significance of the Chechenian in Jordan at the time. But it really fascinated me, because the idea of taking a shared taxi from Amman to Grozny, I mean, even to Baghdad was far enough, but Grozny, I thought, was astonishing. What astonished me more is that even before I got to my taxi to Damascus, the Grozny taxi was full and had headed off. So just to start, I thought I knew the Middle East, but I was being taught a lesson that I really didn't know it that well. And it kind of began my search for understanding of the region. Some of you who've read my book, you know that this is a quote that I use for one of the earlier chapters. A quote from an elderly Abkhazian, Abkhazia being next to Georgia, talking about his parents' journey, of which he only knew about, from Abkhazia in the big carts drawn by cattle that were famous at the time, to Sham, which was in his province was really Damascus, and then moving on to the area of the Jolan Heights, where they settled, and then his experience was then being pushed out of the Jolan Heights in 1967 and heading back to Damascus and starting all over again. It's a story I heard many, many times, and it's a story of migrations, really, that pretty much characterized the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, and then we have a period of more localized forced migrations, and now we've come to the 21st century, where we have another whole catalog of displacement and dispossession. But it's the 19th century movement that I want to talk about today, and not in great detail, but I give you some elements of that I think are important to understand how those movements were then managed by the Ottoman Empire. This is a new toy I've been given, so I'm just trying to make sure that I get it right. So this exceptional period in the 19th century was one of the movement of between 3.5 to 4 million people, mainly Muslims, but also Christians and Jews from the Pale of Europe, which Catherine the Great had just set up about 50 years earlier. So it was a massive movement out of the borderlands between Russia or the Russian Empire, some of the edges of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, into the Ottoman Empire. The movement was of Crimean Muslims, who called themselves Tatars, Circassians, Abkhazi, or Georgians, I guess we could say today, Chechens, Dagestani. And I'm going to focus on the Circassian group as I lump them together, because I think it's with a response to those massive numbers that the Ottoman Sublime Porte responded to, starting from 1860 up until really the beginning of the 20th century, with very interesting response to this movement of people. One of the main efforts of the response, and I'll go into that in detail in a minute, was to make sure that people of one ethnicity or one ethno-religious group didn't collect in one area. The policy was always of dispersal, and that dispersal fit in with the Ottoman idea of the dhimmi and the millet, which I just indicated here, which were the ethno-religious communities that made up, I would say, about 40% of the population of the Ottoman Empire. The Christian and the Jewish minorities were pretty large minorities up until the period of the nationalism in the Balkans, where one state after another began to split away with the help of Russia and the European powers. So I've put out a couple of articles that really go into detail about the dhimmi and the millet. I'll say a little bit about it here, but I guess what I want to identify as perhaps the most important aspect to keep in mind is that throughout the empire, the millet was an ethno-religious community, if I can put it that way, that had its ties horizontally across groups, but not vertically into a particular physical place. So the biggest of the millets was, of course, the Muslim millet, which included Turks, Arabs, Albanians, etc., etc. They could be spread out over large areas of the empire, but they were ruled following a particular ethno-religious legislation that was pointed at them. The same for the Christians. The Christians could be Serbians, they could be Bulgarians, they could be Syrio-Palestinian Christians. They were ruled by a particular millet. And these millets were also then, over time, during the period of reform, which is called the Tanzimat period, were then ruled by their own religious hierarchy. All matters of family law, marriage, divorce, birth, death, inheritance, property. I don't know what else there is to be ruling on, but this was all ruled not by the Ottoman courts, but by the particular religious institution set up for the Catholics, for the Apostolic Christians, so the Greek Orthodox and the Armenian Orthodox were two separate millets. There was only one millet for Jews. Most of the Jews at that time were Ladino or Sephardic Jews, who had come from Spain, or what we call the Arab Jews, the Mizrahi, who had, I guess, never bothered to convert to Christianity or to Islam because they were very happy with their own religion in the Middle East region. I'm going to come back to this policy later on, but also in this talk try to show how the current Turkish migration policy has really been built up on what I would call really extraordinary tolerance for minorities during the Tanzimat period, and even now Despite the Turkification project from 1920, which now is beginning to come apart a little bit, we can still see examples of really quite extraordinary openness in terms of granting of asylum. I mean, I think very few people know that the current Turks, during the most recent wave of Balkan uprisings in the 1990s, accepted quite openly nearly 200,000 Bulgarians who sought asylum in Turkey. And now, in fact, also what they're doing, they've moved far beyond what any of the other states in the region have done, although Turkey is a member of the, is a signatory to the 1951 Refugee Convention. It has a particular proviso that it only deals with refugees from Europe. However, starting in 2013 and moving up to the present, they have now gradually, but really significantly, put into place regulations granting secure legal status to refugees entering from Syria. They've issued ID cards, they're providing free healthcare and free education, and this is far more than is happening in any of the neighboring states. So, a map just to remind you of the extent of the Ottoman Empire that we're talking about. I just make a few issues. This area that we call the Balkans, which I'm now including Greece, because at that time, certainly before 1832, was part of the empire. This is what was always called the European Empire, Ottoman Empire, and 40% of the population of the Ottoman Empire lived in this area. And again, its composition was about 60% Muslim, about 40%, 45% Christian, and about 5% Jewish. So what I want to look at is the way in which the wars between Russia and Turkey ended up with millions of people fleeing. The most important one I'm going to talk about was from the Crimea, where, if you remember your history, the British and the French sided with the Turks against the Russians. But the actual spark for that war, which resulted in millions of people leaving, had to do with the key to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which the Ottoman Sultan had decided to grant to France. And the Russians were very upset that they didn't have that key. So many people don't look at the Crimea as a religious war, but it certainly was. So really, with the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, we saw the three big empires collapse: Russia, the Austro-Hungarian, and the Ottoman. I have given you a little bit of an introduction of the way in which the empire was organized, and from the few conversations I've had with people who recall their parents' lives in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they say this kind of tolerance for minority groups wasn't that unusual. There was a kind of local cosmopolitanism. Certainly in the late Ottoman period, there was, during the reform movement, a great move to federate these separate millets or religious communities and manage them as they were spread out throughout the empire. One of the first, with the collapse of the empire, particularly as, I'll just go back to this, will this go back? Yes. As the Balkans began to be divided, first Greece and then Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania, there was this great unmixing of peoples, and mainly the outflow was of peoples from the Caucasus region. Most of these people, as the Russians defeated the Ottomans, moved, surprisingly, not south, but they moved to the Balkans, and then after the next wave, they progressively moved then further and further into what we now think of as the Levant. I don't think I need to say too much about that movement, except that the only way that most of these 4 million had of moving was south. Europe really wasn't open to them. So I'll just go over some of these battles. I don't want to go into great detail, but as I mentioned earlier, the Crimean War, Britain and France and the Ottomans against Russia, ended with about nearly 500,000 Crimeans or Tatars being forced south into the Balkans. The next war, about 10 years later, was another Russian-Ottoman war, which ended up then seeing, that's when Russia moved into the area that we think of as Armenia, and saw the Circassians, the Chechens, and the Dagestani being expelled, and they also moved into the Balkans. So you were getting waves of Muslims coming into an area that had a serious Christian minority, but the 40% was becoming less and less as more of these Muslim refugees were coming into the area. And then I think the last of the great Russian-Ottoman wars of 1877-78 resulted in the massive movement and secondary displacement of the Crimean Tatars, the Circassians, the Chechens, and Dagestani from the area we think of as the Balkans into the areas of the Levant. That was another large number. And then throughout this period, between about 1860 and 1920, another 2.5 million Circassians, Abkhazi, Abaza, etc., started moving. These are people who, I'll explain later why they moved. They were moving sometimes a decade or two after Russia had already taken over the areas that they occupied, but they chose their time to move. So this is really just refreshing the move. The Second Ottoman War meant these people basically went by boat. The Ottomans had to hire steamers to carry people across. So this area became really very crowded with Muslims. And then the Third Ottoman Russian War, everybody moved across this way or by boat. At the same time, of course, we were seeing Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, Montenegro all being set up at that time as really satellite states, some of Russia and some of Europe. Okay, so how was the Ottoman Empire reacting? I mentioned a little bit earlier that this period from around 1840 to around 1880 was the period that they called the Tanzimat, or the reforms, in which the Ottomans were, you could say they were one step behind Europe. They were trying to introduce reforms based on European codes of law. They were trying to introduce a system, a principle of equality between Muslims, Christians, and Jews in the law. A lot of what was promulgated, particularly in what was called the Imperial Decree of 1839, promoting, you know, the individual's loyalty to the Sultan, to the state, to the community, and to the country, I think was the code. It all sounded brilliant. But the big problem was, in fact, that the millet hierarchy, the religious hierarchy, particularly the Greek Orthodox hierarchy, were very opposed to these reforms. And the reason was that they could see that their set of privileges and ability to govern their flock would be desperately undermined by these reforms. And I had one quote that was reported that at the time that the Sultan read out this imperial decree about equality between the three main millets, representation in a parliament, etc., that the Sultan, of course, took out the decree from a red satin pouch and read it. And it was reported that the Greek Orthodox Patriarch then turned around and said, "God willing that this decree not be taken out of its bag again." The idea being the Greek Orthodox didn't really want to see that. It wasn't just the Greek Orthodox. The Armenian church was also very unhappy about it. And the whole idea of a federated governance was something that most of the Christian minorities didn't want. The Christian minorities, on top of their status as millets, many of them also had rights that dated back really to the 15th century capitulations, which is something else, you know, I can talk about later on, which were rights originally granted by the Sultan to various other heads of state. For example, Suleiman the Magnificent in the 16th century granted Francois I a capitulation which would allow all French citizens, when they traveled or lived in the Ottoman Empire, could be governed by the laws of France, This was then later expanded to the right not to pay taxes if you're living in the country, and also for merchants to be able to invest and to carry out all kinds of business using the laws of their country, whether it was Italy or France or Russia. And in time, by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, many of the minority groups decided not only did they want whatever benefits they got from the millet, particularly, let's say, the Catholic millet, but they also wanted the Catholic French capitulations to apply to them as well. So all of these moves to create a kind of federated government with a constitution, with a parliament, which actually had quotas for the Greek Christian minority and so on, were not well received. And in fact, one of the first large Christian rebellions that took place within the Ottoman Empire was in Crete. The rebellion was such that the Sultan was actually forced to remove the Muslims from Crete off the island and to offer them safe haven along the Syrian coast, as long as in some of the cities, such as in Damascus. So from around 1840 to 1860, there was significant upheaval, and many people were trying to leave particular areas that they lived, looking for safe haven. There was a lot of reported deaths from disease and so on. And very limited assistance was granted. Most of the assistance that people had when they were trying to reach asylum somewhere else was coming from the actual municipalities or the town structures where they were passing through. Some of the Sufi orders had public kitchens, they tried to feed people and so on. But the sheer scale of the migration grew to such an extent that the Ottoman authorities decided that they actually had to do something about the movement, which at that time was still quite, I'm going to say, minor. You know, we weren't talking about 100,000 rather than what started after the Crimean War. We're talking about 500,000, 1,000,000 and so on. So in 1857, the Ottomans implemented what they called the Refugee Code. And I don't speak old Ottoman Turkish, but I know that this term is sometimes actually translated as an immigration law. So immigration or refuge, there wasn't a great deal of clarity in the term. But basically, what the Ottomans decreed was that immigrant families or refugee families and small groups with only a minimum amount of capital could be given plots of land with exemptions from taxes and conscription obligation for 6 years when they first arrived. And if they went to the European part of the Ottoman Empire, that would apply, as I said, for 6 years. But if they went to Anatolia, it would apply for 12 years. So you can see there was an effort to kind of bring people in. But these immigrants or refugees, basically they had to agree to cultivate the land and not to sell it. And in some cases, they put a proviso that they couldn't be sold for 10 years or couldn't be sold for 15 years. A lot of that depended upon how rich the land was. And part of it was also in order to prevent what the Ottomans felt would be land speculators. This decree created a bit of a flurry in Europe, because the news of the decree spread along the frontier zones into Europe, and the Ottoman Sultan began receiving requests from small families, farming communities in Switzerland and Italy and Austria, also quite a few from Poland, to emigrate into the Ottoman Empire. So it was immigration, but it was also asylum. And most of these requests were actually accepted. There were one or two that weren't, and I'll mention them in a minute. Anyway, the numbers were so large that by a couple of years later, in 1860, the Ottomans decided they actually had to set up a commission. So they set up what was called the General Administration for Immigration. It was actually part of the Ministry of Trade. I mean, you would have thought it might have been Ministry of Interior, but it was the Ministry of Trade. And very successful, and it was now setting out to find ways of dealing with the massive numbers of Circassians, of Tatars, fleeing these areas that were conquered by Russia along the Black Sea, as well as the thousands of non-Muslim immigrants who were coming into the area, and it also included a few of the intellectuals from Hungary and Bohemia. So that carried on for a while, and at the same time as these massive migrations were taking place, the missionary activities, particularly of the French and the British and some American missionary activity, they also began to try to get involved in the provision of aid. And so this agency actually took over the role of coordinating in-country aid with the international community, as well as the feeding, clothing, and sheltering of forced migrants as they proceeded through the cities and the towns and villages to the areas that the Ottomans wanted them to settle in. So there was some direction in the places where the Ottomans allowed people to settle. Along with this large group were a number of Cossacks from the Russian army who had defected and had settled in areas around Macedonia and Thrace. And the Bulgarians who had been in that area had been moved out into the Crimea, but they also felt they didn't want to be under the Russian imperial reign. So many of these groups, so you had deserters, you had people who had been resettled, who didn't want to be resettled, also joining these large groups of migrants or refugees. So I'm just going to say a little bit about the Circassians, because I think their movement was really quite interesting. They were the first group to be turned into kind of like warrior townships, if I can put it that way. The Circassians and the Chechens throughout history have had a reputation for being great warriors. They were almost always part of the Ottoman Empire or the gendarmerie of some sort. And as they began to be... Let me just go back on that. So they were in these areas, and as I mentioned earlier, after 1880, the Russians in the last Treaty of Berlin insisted Circassians, Chechens, and Dagestani had to be moved out of this area. Russia didn't want to have anything to do with them. So they began moving, some of them by boat, some of them by land, and they began settling, and you can't see it very clearly, but I've indicated the white dots to show where they all eventually settled. Many of them, for example, landed at Latakia or at Tripoli or Beirut, and then were told where they were going to be given farming land. But all the farming land was on this strip area, which was really the border area between agriculture at the time and the Bedouin grazing lands. During the 19th century, there was a lot of jostling for supremacy amongst the Bedouin, trying to bring these villagers under their control. So the Ottoman persuaded... or basically said, well, if you go here, I'll give you 17 acres. If you go here, I'll give you 35 acres. And if you go here, because it's really the toughest, I'll give you 50 acres, plus some animals, et cetera. So this area then became how they were widespread. Because the Circassians, the Chechens, and Dagestani were so militaristic and had quite a significant hierarchy, as well as thriving serf-slave element, the Ottomans took all the ruling classes and basically left them either in Istanbul or in Damascus or in Beirut to separate them out from those who were now going to be settlers and start extending the area of safe agriculture. So obviously over time, these groups of Chechenian, Circassian, Dagestani became deeply embedded in what we know of as Syria, Jordan, and also there are a number of villages still in Palestine, Israel. This picture was just to break the monotony of one slide after another. The Circassians were so successful in their non-assimilated integration, if you'll allow me to say that. They kept their language, they kept their custom, although they were Muslim. They had some very particular or peculiar customs. But when they arrived in Jordan, besides finding that the land that they had been given was also then selected by the first King Abdullah or Emir Abdullah to become the capital of Amman, suddenly they found themselves as actually landowners of property that over the 20th century became extremely valuable. They're a very wealthy minority in Jordan today. But what's more important is that when the Ottomans lost World War I, when Allenby moved into Jerusalem, the Chechenian, Circassian, and Dagestani officers took off their jackets and went over to King Abdullah and said, "We're not leaving again, we'll work for you." And they, from that time on, became the what I'm going to call the close security of the palace, the royal palace, and they still are today, and they still wear their Circassian dress. These are all the Circassians. This is, of course, Abdullah I, so it's quite an old picture, but these are the Bedouin, which make up the other security of the Jordan military. So it's a very important element today in Jordan. So let me go on from this image and just say a little bit more. I want to have time for really questions and answers. I've gone over the incentives that were drawn up in order to really move people. These were incentives that came out of the 1857 law, but then implemented in the 1860 commission. And I mentioned that you could be given 17 acres, 25 acres, or 32 acres. That's a lot of land. I mean, I know we're not farmers, but 32 acres, that's a lot of land. It depended upon how secure the region was. If you were going to have to fight off Druze and Bedouin, then you'd probably get 32 acres. If it was a very quiet area, then you might only get 17. By the time we get to around 1887, this part of the Ottoman Empire, which had been pretty much depopulated in the century before, partially because of a lack of interest, the Ottoman Empire in the 17th century was so focused on trying to take Austria, you know, the two sieges of Vienna and so on, that they ignored the hinterland, and the hinterland became rather depopulated. So it was in their interest to see this area repopulated, and that's what happened. So by the time you got to about 1887, there wasn't much land left that wasn't malarial. And the Circassians and the Chechens were clever. They would never go and live in a malarial area. But one or two of the Dagestani communities did, and those communities didn't survive for very long. But after 1880 or so, the Ottomans decided they didn't really have the agricultural land to give these large acres. They didn't really want to cut back too much because they wanted these migrants or refugees to be able to have a viable income. They then turned to actually constructing migrant districts. So one of the first migrant districts or neighborhoods was an area we called Muhajirin in Damascus. And the next sort of migrant district was in the orchards that surround Damascus, which were originally the private meadows or horse pastures of the Sultan surrounding Damascus. And he gave these to the Abaza, one of the Circassian groups, who came a little bit later, after 1880, 1890. So, just recap, so 1860 to 1870, you had this commission, but by 1870, the waves of migrants and refugees kind of died down already. They had kind of managed about 1.2 million, and so the commission was closed down. But then around 1877, they needed to reinstitute a refugee commission, but with it they also established what they called the Charity Commission to provide aid. It's estimated by Shaw and others that approximately 27% of the Muslim population of the Ottoman Empire died between this period of 1850 and 1880. Some of it was because of the forced marches or the expulsions without any provision for food or shelter. And the other estimates is that about 500,000 died en route from the Caucasus into Anatolia. So the new Refugee Commission of 1877, alongside of the Charity Commission, actually was now taken over by the Sultan himself. He decided he was going to manage this, and it really set about carefully trying to provide food aid, healthcare, on the way, also as you're arriving, and it became an employment agency. It was very important to find work for the Muslims, Christians, or Jews as they reached Istanbul, and if they were going further to the other cities. What the Sultan promulgated at the time was the position that charity and hospitality, or refuge and asylum, were actually a religious obligation, and that a percentage of the income that came into the waqf, the religious ministry, would go to helping these people who were destitute. But the Sultan kind of went a step too far. So by the 1880s, there was massive debate, especially in Istanbul, about the scale of immigration. Many in Istanbul were really very concerned about this huge wave of migrants coming into the Ottoman Empire. But the counter-argument was that it was really important to encourage Muslims to leave Russia, where they might end up being forced to serve in the Russian army and then thus fight against the Ottomans if there was another war. And in the end, the debate that won was to encourage Muslims who didn't want to live under non-Muslim rule to settle in Ottoman territory. And so from around 1880, that's where you get this huge wave of Abaza and other circumcircasian groups leaving the area. They could have left around 1850, 1860. They decided to stay and sort of see how life under the Tsarist Russia would be, and in the end decided not to. So the Sultan actually oversaw the travel documentation. He, or I should say his close advisors, agreed about where people should be settled, how large the groups should be that come in, what kind of housing they get, what kind of maintenance they get, and other kind of integration initiatives. And as a side point, it's really quite interesting. In 1898, Theodor Herzl had a meeting with the Sultan and tried to get permission to set up a very large Jewish colony in Palestine. And his argument was that if he would allow, and he was talking about 50,000 Jews basically from the Pale of Europe, that if he would allow this settlement to take place, then the Jews would pay off Turkey's foreign debt, which was actually quite large at the time. And the Sultan, as you know, he didn't approve. He didn't agree with this deal. But his objection to the deal was nothing to do with religion. It was about he didn't want to have a large ethno-religious community in one place. Because at the same time that he rejected the entry of these 50,000 that Herzl had in mind, he was accepting visas from Jews applying from Odessa and Sebastopol and so on in small groups of 10 or 12. So it's really quite interesting once the Sultan got involved in trying to manage reception. So lessons learned. Are there any lessons I've learned? I think there are, but it's something for us to talk about. What I particularly found interesting was the way in which the Ottoman Empire decided to manage the in-country movement of this large waves of destitute people without internment camps. You have to remember that some of the first internment camps were set up around 1860 in the United States at the end of the American Civil War, and there was communication. So there was knowledge of this policy, but they decided not to do that. They also decided that the initial feeding and clothing and sheltering of these refugees as they moved from one city to another needed to be decentralized. So the cities, in most cities, there was a one piaster tax, which I don't know, I guess in this day and age it might be like £10 per head, male head of household, in order to help provide the food and clothing. But the mosques and the Sufi lodges, which we call taqiyas, basically had a policy of feeding anybody who came. So there were, these were like public soup kitchens, which were, they were in place for migrants, people doing a pilgrimage, Sufis teaching and so on, and they were they expanded their activities so that throughout the region, as the refugees moved, you could almost always find a taqiyya, a soup kitchen, to get a hot meal throughout the day. And this is something that the Turks are doing today in Turkey as well. So I guess I'm saying that it was the incentives for self-settlement, this sort of giving people some agency, although they were certainly telling them where to go, because the first wave over the first 30 years was definitely not urban. It was all agricultural. But as they ran out of space, they then began to work on trying to find a way of integrating the refugees in the cities and towns. So over these, you know, past 150 years, the Middle East region has actually been the place of first exile for and refuge for millions of people who really had no choice. Europe wasn't interested in having any of the Muslims. Some Christians obviously did manage to find social links and move west rather than south. But I guess the fact of it's being the first place of exile, I also attach to the millet system and also the residuals of the millet system. This acceptance of the other, of the ethno-religious group, which might be next door to you or maybe in the next neighborhood, this great emphasis on mixing of people and not allowing what I call the ghettoization. You could have a neighborhood, but the neighborhood would still have a mixed element to it. And also, as well, the recognition of mobility, the great movement of people around from the different millets. You could move from the Armenian millet in Istanbul to the millet to Cairo, to Jerusalem, later on to Amman. And this was something that was very widely tolerated. So I just will end with the question. I'm just wondering whether we're beginning to see a new Ottomanism. I recently had a chance to see how the Turkish government is responding to, I guess, about 1.6 million refugees from Syria in the country. They certainly did set up refugee camps there along the southern border that house about 200,000 people. But these are camps that are more like, I'm going to call them domestic residences, that you have freedom of access, freedom of entry, freedom of exit. Most of the population is self-settled, spread around the country. The Turks were a little bit slow. It took them about 2 years to put the domestic law, which they approved in April 2013, actually into effect. But now they have. So self-settled refugees are entitled. They always were entitled to health care and education, but they didn't know it. And because they didn't have cards, many weren't willing to be too open about who they were, where they came from. But it just seems to me that the Turks have moved really quite far in terms of the way in which they've decided to provide refuge and asylum to those who are fleeing from Syria in their country, very different from what Lebanon is doing or Jordan or Egypt. So whether it's a residual trait of tolerance of the 19th century millet system or not, whether it's, as some more cynical observers would say, it all has to do with the EU pre-accession talks that the Turks are engaged in, I have to leave that up to you to decide. So I'll stop here and take any questions.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Studies Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/connect.